You're listening to the MoneyWeb SAFM Market Update Podcast.
It's Personal Finance Monday, and this week we are taking a look at what you need to know if you plan on buying your first car. Many of you have taken to social media of late to say that there are certain things you didn't know when you bought your first car, and you've been given an interest rate north of 20% or close to 20%, and how were you assessed, and all of these other questions. And we thought, why not bring in a financial expert to help navigate all of this? I'm joined on the line by the head of financial planning and advice at Momentum, Bertie Nell, to take a look at these aspects. Good evening, Bertie. Thanks so much, as always, for the time. Let's take the conversation from the top. We're looking to buy the first car, or we're looking to buy a new vehicle. Where do we start?
Yeah, Jimmy, first of all, thank you again for the opportunity. Yeah, it is always, I couldn't use a more practical example. I'm sitting with a person in home that started working and wanted to buy a first car. So we went through this experience in about 2 weeks back. And the options is just so wide. I mean, you get all these advertisements in papers and media saying you can afford a car and you're starting with a payment from so-and-so. And then it looks very attractive to buy the car, to make it from an affordability point of view very attractive. However, there are certain very, very important things that you need to take into consideration before you go into this exercise. It's not only about the payment of the installment. It's various other costs that you need to account. And in the end, it all comes back to, can you afford it in your budget? And I think that's where it's so critically important. We all want to drive new cars or a first car, and we most probably shoot a bit higher than what we normally should be. And I think that's where homework is so critical in this exercise, not to keep up with the Joneses, but to look at what your budget can afford.
Bertie, let's look at some of those things that go into the decision that's going to be made. What numbers do we need to factor in? Obviously, there's things like a deposit, like the balloon payment, like the insurance. What are the numbers we need to be aware of?
Yeah, Jimmy, I think there's some costs directly or expenses directly related to the purchasing of the vehicle. And that's normally where your financing concepts comes into play and the various options that you can play, whether you're going to deposit, what's the term that you're going to pay it over, what's the interest rates applicable, is it a fixed or a variable interest rate, is there a balloon payment or so-called residue value at the end of the term, because all those factors, by playing around with it, you can make a car very attractive and very affordable. But there's some serious consequences down the line that you never took into consideration when making the ultimate decision. That's the direct cost. Over and above that, it's keeping that car on the road, if I can call it that way. It's the insurance that you need to take out. It's the fuel that your consumption that you need to take into consideration. The insurance component of insuring that vehicle. Yeah, there's other implications that you need to take to varying licensing costs, etc. Maintenance. I mean, you're looking at is a maintenance plan included? Is it not included? So there are so much variables in that decision that you need to be very careful, and it can be a minefield if you're not properly consider those and taking care of those decisions.
Bertie, let's look at some of these numbers in greater detail, because some of the decisions are bigger decisions that need to be taken as well. Should you be putting down a high deposit on a vehicle? And if so, what benefit does it have towards things like the interest rate? Does it reduce the interest rate, or does it give you a more favorable interest rate with the banks?
Yeah, I think there are other considerations that the bank will normally take into account in granting an interest rate or making it profitable. But of course, the less they finance, the more banking products they got for their own bank or whatever, the more leeway they can play with interest rates deductions, if I can call deductions in that matter. So they can offer you lower interest rates depending on the credit risk of the consumer. So I assume that with a substantial amount that you can put down in a deposit, that will imply that you're borrowing a lower amount. And taking into account your credit score, etc., that might have a significant impact in the interest rates that they can offer. So, of course, the lower the interest rates, the lower the monthly installment that you pay on that vehicle. But it's also important that you look at the term over which you want to finance that. So you can have substantial periods up to 72 months to finance that, or you can shorten that period. And of course, the higher the amount of deposit that you can provide, the lower installment you pay, the shorter period you pay for that, it has a significant amount over the long run at the total cost that you actually paying for that asset or that vehicle.
Perti, how do you avoid, as a first-time buyer, being charged exorbitant interest rates? We've seen time and time again consumers coming out to say that I was financed at 16%, I was financed at 18%, I was financed at 19%, and those are exorbitant rates considering that our prime lending rate is almost 7% lower than some of those figures. How do you, as a first-time buyer, position yourself so that you don't get the wrong end of the credit financing deal?
Yeah, I think it's so important, like everything you do, shop around and make sure that you're trying to procure the best interest rate that you can get. Of course, certain factors, unfortunately, can't lower those further. I mean, if you're a first buyer, payment record, credit record, etc., is all playing a role in granting those. But I mean, looking at prime plus factors is critical. I think for a first buyer, except if you've got a significant credit record up to date, to get lower than prime is highly unlikely, but it's not impossible. But you might get even people, and I've seen it now. We started off with prime plus 10 for a first time buyer, but over time we could negotiate those rates down to get significant, and also the long run of the employment factor of that individual. Can he maintain that payments for a substantial period of time? So if, say, for instance, he financed over 60 months, is there a highly probable situation that he would be able to service, he or she can service those debt over that term? And that will all rely into the interest rates that banks will put into their so-called calculators in order to get to a specific rate that they can offer a consumer.
Perti, I want to look at the balloon side of the conversation. I remember when I purchased my first vehicle, the interest rate was quite high. I was given the option for a balloon payment, and I was told that my balloon payment financing would only really come into effect at the end of my term for the agreement, or for the sale agreement with the bank. I elected to take the balloon, obviously, and my thought process there was, in taking the balloon, I would set up a separate fixed deposit on the side, and on a month-to-month basis, I would divide the total balloon amount by the amount of months I would be required to save up towards that balloon, and I'd put that money aside, and then at the end of it, I would have the money for the balloon. Do you go into these agreements with a balloon or without a balloon?
Yeah, Jimmy, again, that's a component that's making it very attractive from a buyer perspective to have a balloon payment. However, the impact of that and the consequences thereof can be dramatic. To your point, there are various alternatives. If you've got additional money to put into the or put aside for the payment to provide for that balloon payment, perhaps I should just first of all explain the concept of a balloon payment. So a balloon payment is nothing more than your final payment being in an excessive amount, either 20, 30% of the original value or purchase price of the vehicle. So if you buy, for instance, a vehicle of 500,000 and you've got a 30% residue or balloon payment to that, it implies that at the end of the term, you need to pay 150,000 once off, over and above in your last installment, which over the term of the payment will increase the interest portion that's payable, because that's an outstanding amount on which interest is levied. So whether you do it in a different vehicle, making provision for that 150, you're in any event going to pay that excessive. So you're either going to earn the interest in something that you build up and have that 150, for instance, available at the end, or you could have just as well pay payment in excess, that additional amount into the vehicle finance, and in so reducing the end, so that you're actually reducing the payment of that vehicle over a shorter term. The risk of having a 150 or an odd balloon payment at the end of the time, there's various risk factors that implies to that. You're either going to be tempted to buy another vehicle and you can't get the money that you're actually still owing outstanding on that vehicle in a trade-in or a replacement value. The vehicle might depreciate quicker than what your outstanding amount might be. There might be other factors you want to upgrade. There's another factor that you can't do it. So I think there's serious risk of negative equity in that space, penalties. And you had in the past, and I don't know, I'm not an expert on that, whether that's still available. Some vehicles you can have a guaranteed residue or balloon payment or guarantee value that you can actually, at the end of the term, either trade that vehicle on a new vehicle and you're guaranteed for that amount. But the risk is, if you haven't got those guarantees, that you might end up easily need to refinance that vehicle at the end of 6-7 years, which is a 6-year-old car now, and you need to refinance that $150 if you haven't got the money. Like what you did, I think it's the minority of consumers that's got the discipline to go into that and put additional money aside in order to make up for that balloon payment at the end. Some of them would just say, okay, I'm just going to spend this on lifestyle or other assets, and in the end they get it at 72 months or 60 months outstanding capital amount of to be paid, and which result that they say, listen, I haven't got that money at the moment. And what do you do then? Either they need to sell the vehicle at most probably a lower value, or they need to refinance that over a further term of whether it's 36 months or 48 months. In the end, you're actually paying your vehicle over not 60 or 72 months, but over 72 plus 36 months, for instance. And that, for a lifestyle asset that's not like a residential property or something that over the long run you're going to get the benefit of, it might be a very risky decision or a very unthoughtful decision that you actually made in the end.
So I think the point here is to take into account the amount holistically, including the balloon payment, if you elect to go that route. If you can avoid it, but we often know that first-time buyers don't necessarily have additional disposable income for them to make this sort of decision. Bertie, I want to look at something you mentioned around the dangers of the financing component here. When we fast forward 5 or 6 or 7 years, we've gone through the term of this sale agreement, and now something like a balloon payment is outstanding, and you want to roll that, or so you trade in the vehicle, for example, and you still have that outstanding debt, and you now want to roll that into the new car. Yes, that is a possibility, but what are the dangers of doing that?
As I said, I mean, at that point, the value of the vehicle might be less than the actual outstanding amount on the balloon payment that you need to do. So if you want to trade that vehicle, you might get less for that vehicle than your outstanding balance would be, which would result in a shortfall that you need to come up with that capital. And that brings us to buying the next vehicle. So you're not in a position to be bettering your situation by buying a vehicle. You are just getting to terms with the old vehicle and settling that amount. So I think it is something that you need to be very careful about on what are those implications in the long run. So it is not only by as I say, you can use that vehicle as a payoff for that thing, and hopefully over time the value of that vehicle didn't depreciate that much that you actually can get a further deposit for something. But my long run is, I've got a friend that always say there's nothing driving as good as a vehicle that's paid off fully, that you don't owe any money on. So that gives you peace of mind. Unfortunately, we know the reality is not the average South African out there hasn't got 500,000 or even 200,000 to buy on spend on a vehicle in cash. But if you've got that privilege, then the more you can pay in cash for that vehicle, the better it is in the long run.
Be smart about your finances. Plan. Do your research. And most importantly, don't be afraid to ask all of these questions before you sign the agreement. We'll leave it at that, Bertie. Thanks, as always, for those insights. That's Bertie Nell, who is the head of financial planning and advice at Momentum, joining me to discuss how you plan for purchasing your first car.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb SAFM Market Update podcast, uploaded weekdays at 7 p.m. For more MoneyWeb podcasts, go to moneyweb.co.za or the app and follow MoneyWeb News for daily updates.